Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements? I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science wherever you get your podcasts.
The Trump presidency was always going to end like this. It was always going to come to violence. This is not me being an opinion columnist. Donald Trump told everyone what was going to happen, like multiple times over years.
In the good old days, this doesn't happen because they used to treat them very, very rough. And when they protested once, you know, they would not do it again so easily.
Knock the crap out of them, would you? Seriously. Okay? Just knock the hell. I promise you, I will pay for the legal fees. I promise.
I love the old days. You know what they used to do to guys like that when they were in a place like this? They'd be carried out on a stretcher, folks.
The audience swung back. And I thought it was very, very appropriate.
Try not to hurt him. If you do, I'll defend you in court. Don't worry about it.
And yes, naturally, when Donald Trump found himself in front of what might be his last rally crowd as president, he did the exact same thing he had been doing for 2 months.
Our country has had enough. We will not take it anymore. And that's what this is all about. We're going to try and give them the kind of pride and boldness that they need to take back our country. So let's walk down Pennsylvania Avenue. I want to thank you all.
And then, as everyone knows by now, all hell broke loose.
It is hard to put into words what exactly we witnessed today because we have not seen this before.
Angry supporters of the president advancing on the Capitol.
USA! The evacuation and lockdown of Congress itself, where lawmakers were all set to approve the election result.
Protesters who smashed through the doors, broke their way into the Capitol, making it to the Senate chamber, and throughout the Capitol, overwhelming police.
Leading to unimaginable scenes and violence. One woman was shot and killed, and several police officers were hurt.
Now, last fall, we had a forecaster on this show to discuss how the transition might happen. If you listened, you might remember that he predicted it would not end well, and probably wouldn't end peacefully. And it hasn't, and there's still 2 weeks left. But the real question is not what happens today or tomorrow, or even really on January 20th. The real question is what happens next month, next year, next time there is a democratic crisis somewhere else in the world, next time another country faces down a politician wearing a populist cloak and calling for violence against the elites and against the media. Was this the end of something bad, or was it the beginning of something worse? And as the country that has for many decades now been running just a few years behind the United States on most trends, just how far from home is the behavior we saw in Washington, D.C. this week? It couldn't happen in Canada, could it? Jordan Heath Rawlings, this is The Big Story. Balkan Devlin is a senior fellow at McDonald Laurier Institute. He is a super forecaster for Good Judgment Incorporated. He is the forecaster I mentioned in the introduction. Hello, Balkan.
Hi, Jordan.
I'm going to ask you just to start because for the last 36 hours, I've seen a lot of different language used to describe it, and you're somebody who deals in a lot of geopolitics. What words would you use to describe what you saw in Washington on Wednesday?
Well, unfortunate would come number one, shocking number two. But first, maybe it's useful to put out what word I will not use, and that is protests. So that is not obviously a protest.
Right.
People used words like insurgency, sedition, terrorists, and so on and so forth. I think the best actually term that describes what is happening, or the people who stormed the Capitol, will be cultists, because that's what to me seems like they were Trump cultists and not necessarily protesters. And of course, it was the boiling up of weeks and weeks of whipping up anger and fury by President Trump on its base about the election and the election results. And this was, the writing was on the wall. As you said, I'm not the only one who were expecting something along these lines, because the playbook was very, very clear from the beginning.
Why do you think, if, you outlined it so clearly for us in November, other people mentioned it many, many times, pointed to, repeated use of violent rhetoric. And, on Wednesday was certainly not the first time that Donald Trump, urged his followers on to push the boundaries. Given all that, why did we still seem surprised? Why did the police still seem surprised? Why weren't we ready for it?
I think that's the big question going forward once the shock of what happened is over. How come one of the most secure buildings in the world is overrun by a few hundred people waving flags and this and that? How did that happen? And I think there are basically two answers to that. One, either it is criminal level negligence on the part of the DC police and whoever is responsible for protecting the Capitol, thinking that, well, they will just march and they will not do this. The second one is, and that's, I think, even a worse outcome, is that they were just standing aside and letting people do it. And that is a much more worrying possibility. But either case, it has to be, we have to figure out who is responsible and what was the chain of command that went through this, and how and why, what was supposed to be one of the most secure buildings in the United States and everywhere else in the world happens to be overrun in this manner. I think that's the biggest thing that we will need to figure out. Was it gross negligence and incompetence, or was it an intentional act of allowing this mob to rampage through Capitol?
In the short term now, for the less than 2 weeks that is left in Trump's presidency, what does this mean? What happens next? Is he still running the show as we're speaking?
That's the big question. There is increasing push to get him out of office, either through, 25th Amendment or an impeachment and whatnot. I'm not sure that's going to go through. There was a lot of pressure going on yesterday and will be today, but I'm not sure about it for two reasons. One, the signs that what it requires is, of course, Vice President Pence and eight cabinet secretaries to invoke that and send it out. But we see, for example, today the transportation secretary is resigning, and so people are jumping ship rather than trying to push such a change. So I think the road to invoking the 25th Amendment is not very clear, or getting less and less likely. The second one is I think a lot more worrying aspect, and that is when a YouGov poll yesterday, a snap poll in the middle of what is going on in Capitol, found that 45% of Republicans found what is going on in Capitol justifiable, and they support what is going on there. And that's, half of Republicans think it is okay for a mob to sack Capitol. And that is unfortunately not lost on most of the Republican establishment, including the one in the House. I mean, remember, despite all what happened, the majority of the GOP representatives in the House voted to overturn the results, right? So they are not, so they would, you know, despite all the sort of outrage they might be expressing in today and tomorrow in the next couple of days, they also started to think that, well, if half of the base thinks that was okay, and I will be, you know, facing elections in the next 2 years or whatnot, well, should I push for the impeachment of the Trump base, of President Trump? What will be the base reaction? So I think they will get a lot of cold feet. So I think that there will be increasing pressure coming from Democrats and others and the media to invoke either the 25th Amendment or, you know, to carry out an impeachment. But I'm not sure that there's sufficient time to go through it and would have sufficient Republican support both in the administration or in the Congress to go through it. I think there's still maybe a 15-20% possibility that could happen. But I don't think so. So I think Trump will finish the term. Now, what happens is I think there are two possibilities there. He either will make a deal in the sense that, okay, I will stop burning down the House in return for, you know, for an agreement or safe passage sort of argument that they will not be coming after him after the election, or that he will need to lash out somewhere else. If he cannot do what he wants at home, my fear is that he might turn abroad. So he cannot get what he wants domestically. His party is turning against him. You know, Senate Majority Leader and the House Leader and everybody seems to be turning against Trump. So he needs to vent that frustration somehow. And one tool that he still has is the command of the U.S. Armed Forces. And as the Commander-in-Chief, he has a lot more, ability to do things. He has a much more latitude in terms of foreign policy. So my fear is that he might turn his attention abroad, Iran, China, somewhere else, and started to engage some level of military conflict and whatnot without necessarily worrying about it. And then there are two, you know, and if you're going to fork that particular future, and then let's say he assumed that he wanted to, you know, order strikes against Iran, just making it up. Well, there are two options. Either the military carries that out or they refuse. I'm not sure which one is worse. In the long term, whether Trump starting a war somewhere in the world or that the U.S. military refuses to carry out the president's order, setting an unprecedented, in that sense, situation that the military refuses the civilian control. So I think we're not out of the woods yet. That's what I'm trying to say. And unfortunately, I don't think we reached the zenith of this messy, you know, chaotic transition yet. And 14 days is quite a bit long time. Somebody commented on Twitter saying that, well, that's about the same time. 13 days is about the same time we had with the Cuban Missile Crisis back in 1962, right? So, a lot, yeah, exactly. So a lot can happen in that particular time. So we will just have to sit and watch. But I think, you know, we don't have to. One thing that worries me is that unfortunately we cannot relax and see that, you know, that Trump's shown himself to be, you know, sort of unable to turn over the election results and carry out his coup and whatever you want to name it. And so we should relax and the political classes coming together. Well, not necessarily. So there's a lot that can go wrong in the next 13 days.
Well, I mean, full disclosure, when we invited you on this program, we were going to ask you about what the end of Trump's term means in the big picture for geopolitics in 2021. And now it sounds like we just have to get through the next 2 weeks without everything falling apart before we can even think about that.
Yes. And I think in the grand scheme of things, I think we will get through in the next 13 days. I sound a little pessimistic, but this is me being a bit optimistic as well. I think we will get through. But there is a chance, there's a risk of escalation. And I think the long-term effects are actually even worse. Whatever he could do in the next 13 days, short of starting a nuclear war, which I don't think he will even do that, even Trump will do that. Because, he has buildings all around the world, so he doesn't want them to be destroyed. So apart from that way, whatever his damage, the damage he would be doing would be limited, however horrible it is, including starting a war. But the long-term effects of Trumpism is what worries me more. You know, there are 70 million people that voted for him. And even if you take a very small sliver of that group to be the core Trump supporters, let's say 10%, we're talking about 7 million people who are completely, you know, bought into this particular cult. And that's a lot of people. And as we see today, some are, you know, definitely not shy of using violence. And there seems to be an increasing amalgamation of various conspiracy theories from QAnon to, you know, anti-vax, you know, crowd to the hardcore Trump supporters, to white nationalists and neo-Nazis and a very broad range of fringe elements coming together in this particular sense. And that particular mixture, that cocktail is explosive. And even, like I said, if you assume only 10% of the voters are, you know, hardcore in this level, it is a lot of people. And that, unfortunately, is still bubbling. I mean, they're not going to disappear suddenly after Trump leaves office, right? So it is not as if, you know, Trump leaves and everybody goes back home and then we're fine. So looking ahead, the 2021, Biden will be very busy putting, you know, fires out both domestically and internationally, perhaps. So we will unfortunately continue to see the aftershocks, effects of what has happened today, both domestically in the United States, but also internationally. But also, this particular polarization is nowhere over, and we will. My worry, and that's not only mine, but a lot of people's, is that come 2024, someone who manages to sort of coalesce that you know, resentment and bubbling of this Trumpian base into a more coherent and capable political force compared to Trump, and that will be a serious security threat to everyone else, including Canada. So that's my worry. So whatever the damage he might do in the next 13 days, short of nuclear war, will be short-lived. But the effect of Trumpism in the long term is more concerning.
I'm Laura Palmer, host of Island Crime. Season 6, Sweethearts, is the story of three teenage girls who were all murdered in Victoria, Canada, within about 12 months.
So she was scared. Something out there scared her.
You just created the playground where predators can really thrive.
She was a 16-year-old girl. She was a sweetheart.
Listen to Sweethearts at frequencypodcastnetwork.com or wherever you get podcasts.
Find your frequency.
I'm glad that you mentioned Canada because, you know, we see conservatives up here not necessarily endorsing the violence that we see down there. And in fact, I think even our conservative premiers condemned it when it happened. But certainly, you know, we have seen the rise of populist rhetoric here. There were several small Trump rallies around Canada on Wednesday. You know, how worried should we be about that style of politics continuing to rise in Canada?
Well, I think it is definitely a concern, but I'm glad to see yesterday and today, coming from the conservative leaders, you know, Erin O'Toole was very clear in condemning what has been happening in Capitol and elsewhere. So I think there is a recognition that the spillover, the possibility of a spillover of this American cultural war or the polarization into Canada represents a major threat to our social cohesion. As I sometimes put it, we have our own issues. We don't really want to import American ones into here as well. And that seems to be a recognition, at least on the establishment part of the Conservative Party and others, that this is something that should be kept outside. And I, you know, given the last sort of leadership race and the people involved in it and so on and so forth, in the Conservative Party, I think the threat is not as worrisome as one would think. But there is still and definitely a concern. And I think that can be and should be made explicit in the sense that importing that sort of rhetoric and Trumpist sort of cult-like approaches to Canada would be very detrimental, definitely, to our political culture.
How do you stop it, though? I mean, how do you make it explicit enough so that it doesn't happen?
I think, I mean, it's, of course, a hard question, but my sense is that it starts by identifying explicitly what makes Canadian conservatism different than say the Trumpist version of it. Even if you are pursuing broadly speaking populist baseline, there are multiple sort of populist examples that one can draw on, which does not necessarily include the Trumpian obsession with conspiracies and hoaxes and all that kind of thing. That's, I think, a very American feature of that. So we need to sort of make sure that what is distinctly Canadian approach to addressing to the very real concerns that actually sort of the populists also identified. There is a reason why they were in a way electorally successful in 2016 and over the years. Like I said, it's not all about hoaxes and conspiracies, but they managed to sort of touch a nerve and build upon that. And it is important to sort of differentiate how we could address those concerns of the people, their frustrations with the system, with the establishment, etc., but not, sort of descent into a conspiracy theorizing, and that starts with the political elite within the movement of the Conservatives and elsewhere to identify that. And I think there is a risk for political gain, to be honest, for liberals and others to try to portray the Conservatives as just Canadian Trumps and Trumpian avatars, and that is a danger thing. I mean, it might work well politically because you create fear, and then do you want what is happening in the United States happen here too? So if you don't, just vote for us. So it might be a good political tactic, but it will be definitely a very bad policy for long term for Canada and Canadian cohesion. So I think that what we really need in that sense is a moderation, but also a sense of responsibility on both sides of the political spectrum to realize that neither assuming the Trumpian rhetoric by the right nor attributing that to the right by the left is a reasonable thing or a smart thing to do in the long term. So that's, I think, also a concern we should have. Not only that the right sort of move towards more Trumpian politics, but also that the left wanted to portray all right-wing policies or the right parties or the Conservative Party as Trumpian and just sort of creating this reinforcing cycle. I think that is a concern, and that requires an understanding for both sides of the aisle, in that sense, to realize that Canada is not the United States, and the Canadian liberals and conservatives are not the American Democrats and Republicans.
My last question for you, because I do like to ask you for predictions. Let's just say this time next year, we're closing in on the end of Joe Biden's first year in office. Has the U.S. climbed back to, being considered the leader of the democratic free world and reclaimed some of the space that I think it's lost over the last 4 years? Or is it just changed geopolitically forever?
I think it's a coin flip. It's a 50-50 proposition. And again, I think part of it is what we mean by climbing back. Would Biden be perceived as a much better deal than Trump across the Atlantic and Indo-Pacific? Sure he will. Will that bring back the same level of trust for the United States from its allies as it was pre-Trump era? I'm not sure. I don't think that 1 year is sufficient. I'm not even sure 4 years will be sufficient to gain the same level of allied trust for the United States that it did have throughout, you know, the majority of the Cold War period. And one of the reasons is that, and particularly this is true for Europe, but elsewhere as well, that the presidency of Trump was a very rude awakening for the majority of the European politicians, who always assumed that, you know, the US will be very Atlanticist and you know, the commitments will be there, and you know, so they can comfortably complain about the small things that they don't like about the United States, but don't really need to worry about US going their own way. At least that was the sort of the majority attitude. And the realization is that, well, maybe that's not the case. Will remain, I think, and also a lot of people in both sides of the Atlantic and also here in Canada recognize that we can no longer be complacent and assume that the Americans will do the right thing all the time, or would continue to protect and act in the sort of the public interest of the Western world, more broadly speaking. So the people in Canada, in Germany, in France, in the UK and elsewhere would start to find ways to hedge against a possible return of a Trump-like figure. And even with the Biden administration, like I said, he will be focusing a lot on domestically. You know, he will try to sort of polish up the image of the United States abroad, but there are forces that are sort of already on the move that would prevent a complete return to the internationalism of the, say, the Obama or the Clinton years and so on and so forth. So that's not going to happen. It will be a much, you know, nicer and gentler version, but I think there is sufficient mistrust now on both sides of the Atlantic, if you think about the transatlantic alliance, that whatever happened this particular year, yes, the leaders in Europe will give the benefit of doubt to Biden, but they will be cautious. So yes, US will be back to a certain degree. Will it be back completely and regain the trust of the allies? I don't think so. And I don't think he will have the time to do the things that would require the allies to go back and trust the United States. And in that sense, yes, things did change for the foreseeable future. And we here in Canada also need to recognize that particular fact, that we need to now think more for ourselves and reach out and work with other allies, both in Atlantic and in the Pacific, to protect our own interests, because, well, U.S. may or may not be there all the time for us.
Balkan, thank you for helping us see what might be coming in the future. And thank you for helping us throughout this tumultuous time for America's political system.
Thank you very much for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Balkan Devlin, a super forecaster for Good Judgment Incorporated. That was The Big Story. For more from us, including that prescient episode from last November, you can head to thebigstorypodcast.ca. You can talk to us anytime on Twitter at TheBigStoryFPN. You can email us, TheBigStoryPodcast, that's all one word and all lowercase, at rci.rogers.com. And you can find us in your favorite podcast player, anyone you choose, Apple or Google or Stitcher or Spotify. Pick it, and if it lets you review and rate us, please do so, and please, always 5 stars. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.
Hi there, I'm Gavin Crawford. I'm a writer, an actor, and a comedian. And for the last 8 or 9 years, I have been navigating life with my mother's increasing dementia. Has it been sad? Yeah. Has it been funny? Also, yeah. That's what my brand new podcast series, Let's Not Be Kidding, is about. It's the true story of my life as a comedian, my mom, and dementia. Let's Not Be Kidding, with me, Gavin Crawford. A new 7-part series from CBC Podcasts, available now.